Welcome back, Steve.
Welcome back, Anthony. You'll be all happy to know that we did sacrifice a chicken during the break. A quick little ceremony. So hopefully all of the demos will run flawlessly at this point in time.
Well, that's setting me up for fail for sure. But I don't know if I can raise to the bar of those demos. That was priceless to watch that. As a regular presenter, the empathy you have for when these little glitches just happen, it's like it's amazing. And then I realized it was you.
and then it was funny.
Then I could relax and just start laughing. Now I've really set myself up. Yeah.
Now you've really set yourself up for failure. All right.
Thank you, sir. Well, let's get started. So I'm going to move into our sixth module for today. So this particular module is going to be on develop customer value with high quality. All right. Let's have a look at that.
I love this one. It dives into some of the technical details that you need to know as well. So where most of the stuff has been focused really at this high level piece, now we're starting to look at some of the technical implementations in Visual Studio. And there are a subset of the questions on the exam that cover in here. So
I need to be a little bit careful with it. So my temptation is to drop down with the developer hat and start looking really, really closely at these things. And again, I don't want my enthusiasm for those tools and technologies to give people the idea or the impression that you really need that for this particular exam, which you don't. All right, so in this module, I'm going to go through defining code quality indicators. We'll have a bit of a talk about incorporating unit testing, a little bit on developed code. We'll look at validating quality and then customizing a team project. I'm going to go a little bit selective on a few of those things there, as we have been doing, just in terms of appropriately weighting based on our experiences with the exam. I will spend a little bit of time on customizing the team project. Again, not a huge topic, but certainly it is listed there as in the study guide. Actually, that reminds me of something, the study guide. So at as good a time as any, I'm just going to pop in there, bring open a browser. I'm just going to type in exam 70-498 study guide. A couple of keywords, let's see how Bing does for me. And that's not quite what I expected. Lots and lots of people there offering to help you get past the exam easily. Sounds a bit too good to be true, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Okay, so this particular page is the exam study guide from the Microsoft website. Okay. In one of the earlier modules, I think module one, where I had a list of some of the exam details on there, I did have a short link to help people, but I mean, clearly I was very easily able to find it there just with a quick web search. So the exam number and then study guide takes you to the Microsoft Learning website. And in terms of the skills being measured, if I go and expand that out, okay, this is basically the checklist. So I think this will probably come up a little bit later today, but just while I've got it open, it's as good a place as any. One of the things that I really like to do is just to highlight all of those things in the study guide, and of course it's a nice long one for this exam. Lots of scrolling going on there, right down to here. And I'll copy and paste that out into Word. I'll probably drop carriage returns in here between each of those to make the list what is actually extraordinarily much longer. And then another technique that I'll have there is go through and self-assess your knowledge. So managing incident response times collaboratively between development and operations. How do you feel about that, Steve? Would you be confident to cover questions that are likely to come up in that topic?
I would love that topic.
Fantastic.
I think that's one of the key things I think that we're seeing today is this DevOps.
Sure.
Doesn't mean they're easy.
No.
It's one of the things that you can have been in the industry for a lot of years and still not grab. But
so you tick the box. You'd say, hey, I'm self-assessing that I'm reasonably good with this topic.
Yep.
So what we really want to do, or what my strategy there is just a quick gap analysis.
Yeah.
So go through that guide. I'm happy with that. Not so happy with that. Happy with these three things. And whoa, what's that topic there?
Yeah.
Go through there and just self-assess your knowledge. It helps you then guide or focus the study where you've got to spend some time.
What is a flexibility matrix?
Exactly.
Right there on Bing.
And the really good news is quick search, done. Your study's three minutes long.
Yeah.
It's not always like that, of course.
Not
sometimes
always.
It's like, ooh, there's a whole area here I've just never needed to do. Yeah. So we've got to put some time and effort into that. But that's a strategy that's worked well for me. Just go through, list them all out, do that gap analysis on your own knowledge and skills, and use that to focus your study.
It's a good idea.
But this is the place to go, and hopefully that was nice and easy to find there. All right, so I just wanted to bring that up, and back to where we were. So I'm going to move into what the study guide says here. So with the study guide for this particular first topic, define quality indicators. Perform a code review, including security and performance analysis, analyzing code for common defects. Calculate code coverage and perform architecture validation. Well, you've already given us a good look at those architecture tools, Steve, so I won't worry so much about the bottom one there. But let's talk about a couple of these things at the top. And I've made a few of those a little bit bolder based on, you know, where I'd probably suggest most people look. Around the performance analysis and security analysis, I wouldn't expect to see too much there in detail or in depth. Probably just a general or an awareness of what those things are, the importance of them. One of the things that I really liked from one of Steve's earlier comments was that we do that performance analysis at the beginning. We start with our load testing. We don't wait till we're finished building it and wow, it runs like a pig. Actually, I've seen little pigs run really fast. Besides that, it just runs really, really poorly. Don't build the product and then realize it. So again, just reiterating something Steve said there, is let's get those performance tests right at the get-go.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think that was really good advice there. So what I want to dig into here is probably a look more closely at code reviews. Now, would you expect to know all of the clicks for the exam? No. That's just not this exam. What you would need to know is the value proposition that code review offers. It's got some great support in 2012, which I'm going to choose to show you. So I'll do a demonstration of that to see how it works. It's also one of those things that I've wanted in this product for a long time. You know, it's having to teach people about, well, there's no kind of formal code review. Go and shelve it. Give it a good shelf set name. Email the shelf set name to a colleague. Ask them to do that. If they haven't responded in a day, remember to re-email them again and ask them. Well, okay, it'd kind of work, but there's way too much human intervention there. So a full workflow-backed code review experience now is baked into the product.
Yep. And there was one on Codeplex you could use before. It was very good one, team review. But I agree. Now it's baked in the product. That's nice.
You know what? I think they've done it really well.
I think so.
I mean, I wanted it there for a while. I've been quite eager to see it. And when they finally delivered on it, I think they've kicked a goal.
Yep. Did a good job.
So basically, it allows you to go and send a request to one or more team members. It'd be nice to be able to say, hey, Bob, can you go and do a code review here for me? But, you know, Bob's buried under some other things. So I can send the code review request to an individual, or I could send it out to two or three people and just whoever gets it first. Or maybe I want to have a couple of people review that code for me. I've got plenty of choices there that I can make. There's a great new diff experience in the tooling. So that differencing tool that highlights the differences. I think they've just done some really great stuff there in this release. Some of the things like that light shading that they put behind the line to show the different the lines that have differences on them, but the darker shading just to draw your eye to the exact method or the characters that changed. It's not going to sell any products, don't get me wrong, but those things that you do frequently and repetitively, it just shaves a second here, second there, draws your eye exactly where it needs to be. And I think that's, you know, these little bits of polish that are just great.
Yeah.
We can accept or decline code review requests from others, so let's have a look at what that experience might look like. I've included the slides or some screenshots there, just so that, you know, after I do the demonstration, you can always refer back to the decks. The decks are available, of course, for you to download.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to give this as a demonstration in just a moment. But what you'll see here is I'm in my work. I'm going to go and request a code review. I'm going to choose one or more people. I'm going to provide some guidance there. And then I'm going to go ahead and submit that request. So I'll demonstrate that in just a moment. In terms of accepting and responding, in the interest of time, I'm not going to log on as another user. I mean, we can jump between those and see the full end-to-end experience. But for the purpose of the exam, you don't need to be aware of these screens, the clicks, and so on. I'll show you a little bit of that, but then talk more broadly about it. So accepting and responding, here we see some requests for a code review. I'm going to go over here and would you like to accept or decline it? If we choose to go and accept it, we've got three areas where we can respond to those people. We can mark up inside the code itself. We can say, look, why are you using this method here? I can provide comments on the entire code review experience. So overall, it looks good with a couple little changes. There's just a lot of different ways that I can provide that comment. Even during that experience, there's the ability for me to put comments in here, and we can actually maintain a fully traceable dialogue between the author that asked for the code review and the person doing the code review. So there's a lot more to this than just having a second set of eyes having a look at some code.
Yep.
Let's go and have a look at a demonstration of that. I'm really nervous about this now after your demos.
You're in an entirely different box.
What if your demo juju just comes over here?
Oozes over, yes.
All right. So what I've got here is I'm just in the VM. I've got Fabricam Fiber open. I'm just going to go and make just an arbitrary change, something really, really low impact there. It's, you know, that's not central to the demonstration at all. I just want to have a pending change. When I go back to my Team Explorer and go into my work, so what I've done here is I've got a pending change. Up the top, I can choose to request a review. I'll go ahead and select that. And it says enter the name of a reviewer. I can go into my list there and say that I'm going to ask Annie to do that code review for me. I can enter in a subject for that. Now, of course, normally I will have pre-selected a task, a work item. So the work item title would normally be listed here. Okay, so, and I think I've included that in the screenshot. So my subject for this code review, please review changes to web.config. I can go in here and I can provide extra details. Now, if my work item was already listed up here, I probably would have placed that text down here in the description. Is there something I'm particularly looking for? Am I integrating with a framework class library that someone else has written, and I want to go and ask them to review my code because I'm using that particular class heavily. So maybe they could offer some extra insight as to how I'm making those calls and am I doing it efficiently. Anything like that I want. I can go down here and I can choose to submit that request. Now that request will head off to Annie, and Annie will be able to see that. If we have a look in here, you'll see that I've got the request that I just created. I've also got another request here that I've gone and sent out. We can go and run queries to have a look at those. If I switch back to Home on Team Explorer and go to my web access, I can go over here and I can see it on the favorite screen there. I can see that I've got my two code reviews there. I can open it up, and of course, code reviews are fully work item backed. So here are my two code reviews as work items in the work item system, and I can have a look at the details of those code reviews from here if I wish. So again, I just wanted to show that feature as a great new feature built into the tooling. But for the purpose of the exam, just having a very high level understanding of what code reviews are all about. So Steve, if I could ask you, what's the real value proposition of a code review? If I go and ask you to do the code review, isn't that just taking more time from another resource?
It absolutely is, and so it's completely waste, and so you would cut it out of your development process. No, seriously, when you look at, I think it was Capers-Jones, he's really just one of the foundational people. He's been working with software development teams since the 60s and just really has amassed a lot of metrics. He's kind of a metrics guy, and he claims that code reviews are the single most effective way to remove bugs prior to shipping code. So doing these code reviews, I think, is absolutely critical. That second set of eyes, just it's amazing what you'll find in a code review. And there is one interesting thing on the code review.
Yes, sir.
It kind of gets me, which is we talk fast feedback, this really fast feedback. So when I send you a code review, I'm going to expect a response almost immediately. In other words, with the code reviews as they exist in Visual Studio today, your job when you get a code review is to almost drop what you're doing and get to the code review. Why do I say that? Because a code review cannot work against checked-in code. So what that means is I send you a code review, and now we're waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And if you take an hour to get back on my code review, I'm hosed. So I've lost this cadence. So that's one interesting thing, is I can't do a code review against historical data. Doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It just means that if you're going to commit to code reviews, don't send them willy-nilly. by any stretch. And secondly, when you get one, you need to treat them very seriously.
Absolutely.
There's a very fast response time.
So I'll add a couple of things to that. So as a team, we're going to want to make sure that we agree that we want to use code reviews. They're an awesome resource. So what you said is you want to drop everything and try and pick that up as quickly as you can. I'll add to that and say, well, no, I'd rather see you either accept or decline incredibly quickly. I mean, it's not to say that if I'm in the middle of a priority one bug, I'm expected to drop that and do the code review.
Yeah, good point.
But don't see the code review request come in and go, oh, I'm busy, I'll get to it later. I would have thought it probably preferable to decline it, to let the person know that we're incredibly busy at the moment on something else, give them the opportunity to request the review from someone else.
That's good.
So
point.
Again, you're not just dropping what you're doing, but that fast feedback, either, right. Hey, I will do it or won't do it, that's still fast feedback.
Yes.
And I think that's a much better option there.
I agree.
Or sorry, not a better option, but just something I wanted to call out as another thing to do.
Yeah.
So another thing that I find with code review is you've made mention of the fact that it's just high value. I always find it's great as a team member to ask someone whose development skills I admire to do the review. It's an awesome way for me to become a better coder.
Right.
I mean, it's that constant learning experience. You'll get beaten around a few times. You might get a few comments saying, what on earth were you thinking? And it's like, well, that's actually really, really good. It's good for the code base. It's good for the product. It's good for the team. But I'm going to learn from that experience and go, well, why? What did I do wrong? And as soon as I know what that was, hey, I'm just a better programmer. So code reviews are really a win-win, and I just don't see enough teams using them.
And don't hesitate to get your teams together and mm-hmm. use a code review process that's group either, where you take that senior developer and they walk through the code and kind of explain why they did what they did.
Yeah.
And finding bugs in the senior developer's code is awesome, right? Especially if you're the junior guy. You love that. And get and code review the junior guys, too, mm-hmm. and let them find out what patterns they could or should be using as part of the development.
Excellent.
Code reviews.
Done.
Thumbs up.
All righty. The next thing I want to talk about, then, is incorporating unit testing. Sorry, more to the point. The study guide says we should establish unit testing standards. We should look at developing a strategy for adding unit tests to existing applications. We want to look at selecting a unit test type. That's got me a tad bit puzzled. And also establishing the code coverage target. So there's a couple of things there, and I know, Steve, you've got a couple of ideas and comments on that.
I do.
Let me provide an overview of some of these things first, then I might even come back to that particular slide and hear those things that you wanted to add for us.
Yep, I'd love to.
So again, this is not technically in the exam, this little thing I'm showing you here. So to be very clear, I mean, the exam goals are one of the main reasons we're here, but you know, part of my personal goal there as well is to just help you understand this tooling a little bit better. One of the big changes they made with the unit testing solution in 2012 was A, they made it just a heck of a lot faster. They redid the entire experience. The new Test Explorer is truly first class. I think they've just, you know, done really, really well. One of the big challenges, I suppose, back in the very early days was, as I was getting people on board with TFS back in 2005, the unit testing experience, it was far from ideal. A lot of the teams that I personally worked with were well invested in NUnit. They liked it. It ran really quickly. In 2005, the unit tests, well, the experience was they ran really slow. They had certainly fewer asserts that were available to us, so teams were just reluctant to change. In 2008, the experience improved, so the unit tests executed certainly quicker, which was a big bonus. But it hasn't really evolved or kept pace with a lot of the other open source or comparative frameworks. So a lot of the unit testing and mocking frameworks out there, they're just constantly evolving, and we just haven't really seen the offering from Microsoft really keep up, if I can say that.
Yeah.
So one of the really nice things here, let me go back to the problem domain. By plugging in these third-party frameworks, you then suddenly, if they weren't reporting the results back into the warehouse, we're losing a lot of the value of some of the reports. You know, we're just not seeing that data light up anymore.
Yep.
So, you know, part of our ALM solution just goes dark. So in the change that you see on the slide there, let's just take a quick look at it. So putting in that unit test platform abstraction layer means that all of the goodness that we see across the front end, the new unit test explorer, the command line runner, and what happens with team build, all of those things work now regardless of the pluggable unit test provider you're using down the bottom. Now, this means that you can use the MS Test plugin for managed code that no one's familiar with, the options for native code if you're a native code developer.
Yep.
But look at these other ones, NUnit, XUnit, QUnit, and a whole bunch more. So you'll be able to plug these in. Now, it's not to say that we want to go out there and mix and match and, hey, I'm going to write my unit tests today with NUnit because it's a Wednesday. And I'm going to write my unit test tomorrow with QUnit because it's Thursday. You don't want to do that. But I see it as teams, you know, pick up code from other team members as we sort of bring in code bases that historically may have used other frameworks. Well, we haven't got to recode them. We haven't got to change them in any way, shape, or form.
I love that. And it's not just those frameworks you can pull in from legacy code, mm-hmm. but it allows you to unit test things that haven't been as easily unit testable in the past. For instance, Microsoft has never shipped mm-hmm. a JavaScript unit testing framework. But I can use Jasmine. I can mm-hmm. use QUnit. I can plug these things in and do some of my JavaScript unit testing. I can do unit testing against F-sharp, for instance. They might have a separate framework that Microsoft just hasn't built. But I can grab it, pull it in, and use it. And so not only did Microsoft allow us to use those other .NET frameworks, but they've opened up this world of unit test frameworks that we can now use.
So, but we could have done those before. We could have gone into our build processes, and as part of the build process, I could have written a little custom build activity in shell out and do those things.
What a pain.
Oh, absolutely.
Every bit of it was a pain.
And what was the cost of doing that, though? Yeah, they'd run, but would they report results back into the warehouse? Would these things light up across the ALM suite?
Not unless you exported a little XML file. What was that called? Format? I don't know. Nah, It was too hard.
So this is a big win. Absolutely a big win. So a quick screenshot there, and that's a little fuzzy for me. If you have a look at the new Unit Test Explorer, this is absolutely great, and I can show you that in a VM in just a moment. But they've put a lot of thought into this UI, and I'm not going to get into the color debate, not even close today, nor am I going to get into the capitalization debate. I think they've been beaten to death already. One of the nice UI elements that I see here, firstly, virtually anywhere you see a list, there is now a search window at the top.
Yep.
So if I end up with hundreds or thousands of unit tests, do I really want to go and categorize them into subfolders and do those sorts of things? Or wouldn't it be easier just to start typing? Just a little quick type ahead narrows the list down. So that makes it really easy. And you'll see that not just in Unit Test Explorer. You'll see it at the top of the build window, for the build definitions. You'll see that UI element pretty much right across the experience. Immediately underneath that red bar, we're seeing the most important thing quickly and conveniently. If I've got 2,000 tests and every test's passing, what do I care about, Steve?
I want the failed ones. What do you mean, care about?
Sorry, sir. I said if I've got 2,000 tests, and all 2,000 are passing, what do I care about?
I just want to know that they're passing.
They're passing, great. So if I was to see a big green line up here that conveyed to me the fact that everything's passing, that's all I care about. Do I want to see a list of them necessarily? Well, yeah, not really.
No, probably not.
If I see the red at the top there, well, that's telling me that I've got some tests that are failing.
Yeah.
Now, that's incredibly useful to me. It means, hey, get your attention over here.
And then, you know, that's an interesting thing because that is only now available because we have kind of the monochromatic interface with very specific meanings for colors.
Yeah.
So I like that.
I think it's great.
Yep.
Up here, we can go in there and we choose what we want to run. Do we want to run all the tests? Do we want to run a subset of them? So you've got flexibility over what you run. And then what they're doing is they're showing us the most important tests first. And by that, what are the most important ones? Well, the ones that are failing.
Right.
I don't care about these ones. Lots of green makes me feel happy, but it's these little red ones at the top that I am most interested in. So I give them prominence. Put them right up the top. Put them right under my nose. So that's great. The next thing is, often when I work with teams, one of the things we always strive to do is to try and close the time for the fast feedback. Builds our challenge there. So builds that are taking 60 minutes, 90 minutes, 2 hours, we're constantly trying to get those builds down. Now, it's often not the compilation. It's not going and creating the assemblies. It's usually, in my experience, the tests. Now, we don't want to stop the tests, but hey, that does make you build so much quicker. Let's be very clear on that. So let's find out where our time is going in those tests. So showing all of the timing here for those unit tests is just great. I'm not going to worry about optimizing this particular unit test here that takes a millisecond. Halving that by investing a day saves me half a millisecond.
Not worth it.
Yay. But then if we go up to some of these bigger ones, well, now we know where we can focus a lot more of our effort. Can we open up and have a look at that particular unit test? Have a look at potentially where the slow parts are. So having that timing readily available to me, I think, is a big win.
And what's interesting is the timing you see here is all really relatively decent timing. Yeah. You've got some good code there. But if you look at tests, a lot of them, they're running into the many thousands of milliseconds. And those tend to also expose integration tests that might be being run all the time. Now, there's no problem using your unit test framework to write integration tests, but you probably want to call them out separately.
Agreed.
As what they are, and maybe not run them on every build.
Agreed. I've got a quick quiz for you, Steve.
All right, fire away.
Looking at that screen in front of you, all those green tests there, what unit test framework were they written in?
They were all written in some pluggable framework, whether it's the built-in one or something else. I have no
Absolutely
idea.
Absolutely correct.
No idea.
No, you made the point completely perfectly. We don't care.
Yeah.
You know, if the top four here are in one unit test framework, the rest of them are in a different one, well, that just doesn't matter for us. You know, they're there regardless of how we got them by assuming other code bases, legacy code, whatever. We just don't really care. We just want to make sure that they run, and away we go.
Is that from the Fabricam Fiber?
It is.
Then they are. They're written in X unit. Mm-hmm. N unit,
yeah,
and
yeah,
with a couple mocking frameworks thrown in for fun.
And yet, again, if you were just looking at this, you wouldn't have known that.
Nope.
And that's really, really powerful.
That is.
Looking down the bottom, the next thing we see there is just a summary of those run details, the total run time, one's failing, and 12 are passing there. So that whole experience is looking really, really good. Code coverage in 2012. So, again, we don't need to dig into code coverage too much, but for the purpose of the exam, what is code coverage? So if I find out that I've got 100 unit tests and 100 unit tests are all passing, can I ship it? Well, of course, it's 100%. Maybe not. Maybe not. I'm not going to be tricked that easily. So what we want to know is how much of our code is actually being tested. So code coverage has been around for a little while there for us. It can allow us to find out, you know, that we're only testing 52% of our total paths of execution through our application code base, and that means there's going to be a large chunk of this that's not being tested. So that's not uncommon, of course, and we don't want to, well, I was going to say we don't want to test 100%. It's generally impossible and certainly not economically viable to test 100% of the code.
No.
Personally, I generally see that around 80 is about the optimum level. I don't know if you have a different opinion on that.
Whatever's right.
Yeah.
80 feels good. 60 sometimes feels good as well.
Yeah.
You know? And when I've got zero to start with, that first 2% feels like...
it's great. It's
awesome.
A great feeling. Yeah. So some of the other things there. So I can certainly point out or help us in identifying the code that isn't being tested. So if I find that I have about 50% code coverage, what do I want to know? Well, show me the parts that we aren't covering. So that can go and put tests in there. So this does that for us. Again, all of these things work with the third-party frameworks, everything that you saw before. And that's been a huge improvement there. So again, depending on the nature of a question there, a given scenario, if we have low code coverage and we need to make that higher, what should we do? A, do more regular builds. B, increase the number of unit tests. C, add unit tests to areas of code that are not currently being tested. I mean, guys, that's not a question. But it's showing you that an example around your ability to take a technology and understand the value that it offers so that we can say, well, look, if this is a particular problem or a challenged area, what of these tools can we use to try and solve some of that?
I love the way you put that, because one of the study guide questions is how do you develop a strategy for adding unit tests to legacy code or establishing unit test standards? And I've seen a lot of companies jump on the unit test bandwagon and say, we got to cover our code. And they immediately walk in and say, okay, next two sprints, we're doing code, unit tests. We're going to cover our code. Well, what a waste.
Yeah.
in a lot of cases. You have to look at the benefit and the cost. And how do you know what code to cover? I'll throw in one, and you can throw in one maybe. I don't know.
Sure.
I like to say, every time you hit a bug, prove it's a bug with a unit test, fix the bug, make sure your unit test is passing. At that point, you now have a unit test that covers a problem area of your code. Chances are, if you've got bugs in that file, you're going to get more and more. So it's a good place to focus that testing effort. That's an easy way to just start getting some real quick wins in potentially problem areas in your code.
Yeah. And I like the strategy there. So go and look for where those bugs exist and then target your effort there. I use another technique. I use annotate, and I basically search for any code that Steve wrote.
Bravo.
Sorry there. Sorry. I apologize.
No, I've been in the process business too long. That might be a good idea.
All right. So moving on to code coverage. Sorry. Now I'm lost. Code clone analysis. Mm. So again, let's call out another quality tool here. Let's talk about the copy-paste programmer. Let's talk about the junior developer that comes on board. They're looking at some code there. They haven't got quite the experience of some of the other team members. They look at a requirement. They go and find some code that's close. They copy-paste it and then just tweak it. Is that right or wrong?
Sure is fast.
It's fast, absolutely. And, of course, those metrics you spoke about earlier in terms of number of lines of code per developer per day.
Way up.
He's doing great.
Yes, he is.
So one of the challenges with that is, you know, any time we duplicate that code, that's another area where bugs exist. It's more code to be maintained.
Yep.
You know, it's just it's against creating maintainable code. So being able to go and find those duplications, not exact perfect copy paste, because often it's copy paste change a little bit.
Yes.
So the code clone analysis in 2012 allows us to go in there and use advanced heuristics behind the scenes to come up and say, well, look, here are the duplicates and near duplicates. And it really goes and tells us where we could refactor those things out, put them into a single location, get them tested over here, and the maintainability of our code suddenly has gone up quite a lot. So, you know, the code clone stuff, I think, is just awesome.
And I really agree. And then I want to tie it right back to those fundamental principles you talked about. Yep. High quality. That's one of the fundamental practices, right? Dry. Don't repeat yourself. So you want to get that out, rip it out so that your code is higher quality, easier to maintain. All of these tools operate below the process level at this developer practices and tester practices level, which is really driving the same type of fast feedback loops, high quality, at a lower level. It's very fractal.
Mm-hmm.
Things work at small levels, bigger and bigger and bigger, all the way up to Scrum or Kanban, where you're delivering value to your customers and getting feedback.
You dropped the K-word and you couldn't help yourself.
I couldn't help myself.
All right. So in terms of a demo of that unit testing, will I quickly do that? So again, just jumping into Fabricam Fiber, into my Solution Explorer, let's have a quick look at this. So I'm going to go into an application that I'm not quite as happy with or familiar with as I should be. That's never stopped me before. So I'm going to go in.
Careful.
Our demo guys have not been
friendly.
And what am I going to do? An ad hoc, ill-prepared demonstration. Way to go. I love that.
Now just knock it out of the ballpark.
So let's actually, you know what, while we're here, we'll do a couple of things. Just while I'm looking at it, I'm going to go in there and, should I show code metrics and other things? I think I'll look at that one a little bit later on.
You can, but while you're here, you might want to pop it in and show it afterwards. Who knows?
I should add that in there as well.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go up to test my code clone. Well, I want to, yes, code coverage, leave that one. All right. Go, go, go.
One way is to pop over to test windows and open up the test window and then run a build. I don't know if you're running it the other way.
Windows, thank you.
You bet. Test Explorer. And then a build will kick it off.
That's what I was looking for. Fantastic. It's strange when you usually leave it docked open. That's a bit of a...
Yeah.
I hate when you have to go into window for something, test for other things just to bring these windows up. But that's okay. That's my complaining. Let's go and run those tests.
And when they're done and you close it, Can I do something after you close it? Oh my goodness! Look at this. You've got a coded. You've got a coded. Whoa!
It's a coded UI test happening.
Are those unit tests?
No.
What's the difference between this coded UI test and a unit test?
Well, so I'll answer the question about what the differences are, but I'll also say that in one regard, that was actually pretty impressive. The fact that that test runner said, look, I'm going to run these unit tests. I found another test that happens to be a coded UI test. I'm going to run that as well. Code coverage is going to work across all of those things.
Oh, that's sexy.
You know, there's some nice stuff in there, to be very, very clear. Now, as a point of law, I do not believe that a coded UI test is in any way a unit test. Unit tests should test indivisible pieces of functionality in a class. They shouldn't drive through the UI. That's just me.
Absolutely. I don't think it's just you. I think it's others as well. It's a good distinction. Plus, unit tests are supposed to be fast.
Yes.
Even though you saw how fast that coded UI test ran, it was still measured in the seconds, in many seconds.
Well, let's actually have a look at the time that it took there. So if we have a look at the times there, 22 milliseconds, less than a millisecond, 1 millisecond, 78 milliseconds getting up. Whoa, look at that, 32 seconds. Now that's, you know, a significant change. So in terms of that fast feedback, you know, this isn't really something that should be there as a unit test.
Three orders of magnitudes. Yeah. But it's still faster than running it manually. So you probably want to run it every night.
So it could be a little bit selective there.
Yeah.
Up here I've got a great option that I can say I want to run those tests after every build. You know, the continual test runner there I think is a great idea. You know, I'm sure I can't remember where the research came from. But, you know, the comparative cost, the earlier you find the bug or the defect, the cheaper it is. And it's almost like it's a logarithmic curve.
Yeah.
You know, finding it once it's deployed to production, the cost's out of the ballpark. Finding it as the developer writes it and they do a build, an F5 on their local machine that runs these tests, and we find that the comparative cost of fixing it is probably one, possibly two orders of magnitude cheaper.
Absolutely. And as someone noted in the comment section earlier, mm-hmm. if you discover it in the requirements phase, mm-hmm. it's another order of magnitude cheaper than in the development phase because you haven't built stuff around it and built cruft.
So that's our little window over there. So again, our little test explorer. So as we saw earlier, I can go and choose to run based on, you know, a number of different things here. Let's go and add some code coverage in there for all those tests. Let's see how the coverage is looking. Looking at the number of unit tests there, I don't expect outstanding coverage results. Oh, of course, it's got to go and run that coded UI again. Okay, so I can have a look down here. We see our code coverage results. I can expand that out and I can drill down in there to have a look at what the paths of execution look like in there. So for example, 100% of the data access layer is not being covered by tests. Bah, that's overrated data access layers. who needs those? We can look at the coverage over here and, well, I'm going to be heartened to say that they're not all zero. We've got some tests. We'll take that as a small win. But the team is well aware that those numbers are well below our definition of done. Rephrase that, where we want to take our definition of done.
Right.
So we're going to be ideally ramping some of those numbers up moving forward. In terms of develop code, so the study guide says we need to be aware, or sorry, we want to have a look at developing maintainable code. Now that's one of the really key things that I'll call out there. This whole idea of let's get it right the first time. You're not going to get it right the first time. If you try, it will lead to over-planning, overly complex code. It'll lead to gold-plating things, and it'll lead to a lot of the waste that Steve spoke about earlier today. Our goal should be to accept that change is inevitable. Our goal should be to write maintainable code. When the change occurs, we want the impact of that change to be as small as possible. We've got great modular, maintainable code. We've got some great tests there. We've got some automated builds. So maintainable code helps really offset some of those challenges quickly and easily for us. In terms of defining our coding standards, well, again, as a great team of developers, we want to have our code standards well-defined, well-understood. defining the application architecture, something that Steve's shown us a little bit earlier. And then there's a little bit there at the end around configuration management, things like the branching strategy, solution structure, source control, with some check-in policies. As a short one there, and again, I don't remember a lot of depth in those particular areas there, I want to call out the ALM Rangers guidance document. Both Steve and I are actually ALM Rangers, and this is a really great place to go to get a great understanding of the branching strategies that are available to you. So for this test, you don't need to know how to go in there and branch and merge and how to do conflict resolution down to the nth degree. That's not this exam. But understanding the role that branching has to play, understanding the strategies and scenarios that it can offer value in, I think is definitely in the scope. So we can do release management through branching. Things like when we name our team projects, payroll 1.0 is absolutely terrible. We never put version numbers in a team project. People love doing that. Why, Steve?
I have no idea.
Because you can't rename it.
Oh, I mean, I know why you shouldn't, but why I don't do know people why do people it? Do no, it. No. I don't know.
Well, because they assume they can rename it.
That's good, yeah.
Go and vote on user voice. I didn't say that. So all of that branching, those numbers, V1, V11, V2, all of that happens inside the version control system. These are names of branches generally, not names of team projects. So this is a great piece of guidance. There's some hands-on labs in there. There's some PowerPoint slides. So you can get the team together. You can put the PowerPoint slides up on the screen. And as a team, we can discuss the relative merits of each of those different strategies.
I want to throw this out as well. Jeff Levinson actually took all of the branching guidance visuals that they had and converted them to a storyboard. Shapes. So you can download the storyboard shapes, throw them into PowerPoint, as long as PowerPoint isn't running in the background. And once it's in there, you can then use the PowerPoint storyboarding to very quickly wrap up and specify what a branching strategy might look like. I love it. I mean, how cool is that?
That's really good.
PowerPoint storyboarding really good. For your branching strategy.
Excellent. We should get him to demonstrate that at some stage.
We should.
Yeah.
We should.
So one of the things that I guess I regularly get asked, and I'm sure you do as well, is teams, when you're talking to them, they say, well, look, we want to, what's the best practice branching guidance? How should we set up our branch? And they really, I guess they're optimistically hoping, I'm going to pull out the magic marker and say, do this, and you won't have any problems. It never works that way. So what I like about the branching guidance is that it gives you the scenario basis. It talks, the best branching strategy, don't do it. If you can have a single code base here with no branching, you've just made life so much easier for yourself.
Yeah, if you're sufficiently mature enough. That's the world's most advanced branching strategy. The single branch is, the world's most advanced branching strategy. It's also extraordinarily powerful. As you take a team that's running across five or six branches and you pull them into a one branch, you are forcing a lot of really positive behaviors. The focus on integration, the focus on potentially feature flags. If you're not sold on that, I don't blame you. It's an extraordinarily painful thing to do. But the book Continuous Delivery really kind of drives home some of the ways that can be of benefit. I'd pick that up and read it. Not for this exam, just for your own personal edification.
I'm sure that some of those opinions that we've just shared there are going to light up in the chat
windows.
Those
aren't opinions. Those are facts. Those are just downright facts.
All right. Steve's email address is
my Twitter account's right there. I can see flames all over the place, right?
They're just from me. For the exam, look, I'd still suggest a quick read of that branching guidance. Get a good understanding of what problems and challenges maybe branching can assist with. And a nice little plug there for the Rangers at the same time. Some great guidance packages.
Absolutely. They do good work. We do good work.
We did good work. Thank you. In terms of a demonstration of that, I don't know that we're offering a lot of value with that demonstration, so I might select.
I would skip over that one. The branching and whatnot, you just don't run into. I didn't run into a lot of things around that area, and it's something that I think most of you are probably fairly comfortable with, and if not, just a few minutes with the branching guide will really wrap that up.
Absolutely. Okay, in terms of validating quality then, In this next topic, what the study guide says we should be most interested in, organizing test artifacts such as test cases, suites, plans and requirements, defining test strategies, managing test execution, test types, associated tools, identifying and configuring environments, and then analyzing those test runs. An interesting thing there, like I read those particular things and my brain went straight into the testing exam. A lot of those topics would typically be done using Microsoft Test Manager. I'd go in there and I'd create some of those things. So what I might do is just provide an overview of some of them, but I probably wouldn't go into a lot of detail there for this exam.
For the next exam, for the test exam, you'll go into a lot more detail, right? I agree. For this one, it's you diving into too much detail here probably wouldn't be suited for trying to focus on this exam.
Yeah.
Although it wouldn't hurt you if you're going for all three exams to really dive into the details here at some point.
Couldn't agree more. And there's another section down there, identifying and configuring environments, that we'll probably dig into probably in the very next topic. So I won't cover that in this one. There's that overlap that we've seen as a common thread through many of the topics we've seen today. So basically, in terms of a little bit of the terminology there, what you've seen here is we've got a test plan with the Microsoft testing tools usually matches an iteration. Okay, so a test plan per sprint. Inside that test plan, we'll then have a group of test suites. Those test suites could be a requirements-based suite that you've seen Steve do earlier today. They could be a static suite, one that I just provide a name for, and I choose exactly what goes in there. Or it could be a query-based suite, where I choose to go in and define a query, and any test cases that match the query filter automatically appear inside that suite. So three different types of suites, and again, a test suite is really just a logical grouping of test cases for both reporting and executing convenience. In the test plan, we also have test configurations. And this is where you really feel for those poor testers that work in environments where it's public-facing web applications, where they've got a raft of configurations, different OSs, different browsers, different versions of browsers, all needing to be tested. So, you know, lots of configurations, well, that's just lots and lots of testing. The lucky guys, I guess, guys and gals, work for organizations where the applications are just internally focused, where we've got a nice, well-defined SOE, so that pretty much we've only got to test against that configuration.
No, those aren't the lucky ones, because organizations like that tend to be focused on just IE6 still. Have to write against that. I don't know.
It should just up and die. Alrighty, so test suites, we spoke about those test suites, the three different types there, and the fact that those test suites are really just groups of test cases. I don't want to go through each of the different testing types, okay? I'll go through this reasonably quickly. So in a scenario-based question, we may need to be able to identify, you know, which types of tests are appropriate for a given scenario. So I won't go into that in a lot of detail, but just quickly skim through those, and of course, they're available for you in the PDFs, in the PowerPoint slides, if you want to go through and look into those in a little bit more detail. So clearly our unit tests are written for programmers by programmers. They can be run manually or automatically as part of the build. That's continuous integration. So unit tests are great like that, and yes, you want to run them automatically. They become a form of code documentation as well. By looking at the unit tests, we can get a very good understanding of the expected behavior of the actual code itself. Manual tests, the majority of all testing done today is manual testing. You know, that's the great domain that Microsoft Test Manager works in. Great tool. So they're typically a list of steps manually performed by a tester. Typically or historically, well, for a lot of companies even today, those manual test cases are written in Word, in tables, or they're written in Excel. And we get the test script, and we simply manually work through them or walk through them top to bottom, looking at the expected results and marking them as a pass or fail. In MTM or TFS, test cases or manual tests are work items. So we record each of those scripts, each of those tests, directly into TFS using Microsoft Test Manager. We include things like the expected results to allow us to have a criteria for passing or failing it. So manual tests, again, the most popular and common form today, and certainly offer high value. Coded UI tests. So in many cases, one of our goals is to try and move off those manual tests where it makes sense. Manual tests, while you know, having certain benefits most clearly, they require testers to manually go through them. Now that's when you build out a lot of test cases, well, you then need either a lot of testers to run them, or you're going to need to be very selective and start choosing which tests to run, which is not ideal. So coded UI tests allow are a form of automated test that allow us to drive through the UI. And the typical life cycle in many cases is our testers might create a manual test case. They'll create an action recording as they go through the steps. When they're happy with the test case, when the UI for the application under test is stabilizing, then we can go and convert them into coded UI. We can add assertions to that, and then those tests can become part of an automated build process, which is absolutely fantastic. And that's important to help the tester, or those, I shouldn't really use the label, I nearly did that, didn't I? The team members that have special skills in the testing area, it allows them to keep pace. As we go from iteration to iteration to iteration, we can't just keep building more and more manual tests. It becomes a bottleneck for us. So coded UI is a great savior there.
I love the way you said run that in the build, because you can run those things in the build at night, and they're running at night in the build, et cetera. When you walk in the morning as a tester, if that test failed, you have a test failure, and you can look at it and see if it failed because, you know, a new version of IE was installed and it popped up the little window, to, you know, do you want to set Bing as your default, whatever, or if it was a real failure. And if it was a real failure, you can right-click, create a bug. And that bug, even though it was running at night, automatically can have a video recording. It'll have a screenshot when the failure occurred. It'll potentially have an IntelliTrace log attached to it. I mean, you get everything you get with a manual test right there with an automated test.
Oh, they're great.
Sweet. Yeah.
All right, the next type of test there I've got listed is an ordered test. An ordered test's a little bit, it's like a pseudo test or a meta test, I might call it. So an ordered test contains other tests that are meant to be run in a specific order. Each test is self-contained and independent. The environment state is not retained between each test that's run. I'm not a big fan of these things. I actually try and, as much as possible, convince people not to use them. In many cases, people use ordered tests in order to be able to get to certain pre-states. So do this test, then this test, then this test. But this test only works if both of these two successfully passed. So we tend to sort of build this chain of tests wherever possible, and certainly developers probably appreciate this better. Especially when you've written unit tests, you want to try and make those tests as completely autonomous as you can. Now, there's a lot of benefits, particularly I'm thinking about test impact analysis here, when it can come and identify those test cases we need to run. If it identifies that I need to run this test case, and this test case suddenly relies on two or three others, you know, having that identified for us automatically becomes virtually impossible. So, not a big fan of ordered tests, but again, we wanted to be clear as to what those things are. The next type of test there is a generic test, and again, it's a little bit of an odd one. A generic test is more of an extensibility point. With a generic test, we are effectively simply shelling out to something else from a command line. We can go out there and call a PowerShell script, a batch file, a little exe that we write, anything we want, so long as that external process can return a pass or fail. So not, in my opinion, a test in its own right, but an extensibility point that allows us to call out to whatever we want and have that treated as a test in terms of reporting.
And if they happen to drop a TRIX file, a TRX file, it'll automatically get popped up and populated into the warehouse.
Which is great.
I remembered the extension, the TRX file.
TRX.
Test results in XML format.
Awesome.
Just had to throw that in there because I don't know how it came back. All right.
Feel free.
Back at you.
Last two. So we've got load testing. In fact, I'm going to switch these. I'm just going to swap those two around. I'm going to go to web performance testing first. So a web performance test. Well, we've probably seen this one before. A web performance test was the web testing that we had in Visual Studio Team Edition for software testers. So a web performance test is much better, you know, name for a start. In 2005, 2008, this was just a web test. And we tried to use that test infrastructure to go in there and to make sure the shopping cart grand total was correct. And we tried to make sure this was on the screen. And it just wasn't a good fit for that. Web performance tests operate at the network layer, HTTP. We use the browser to record them, but what we're really recording then is the network traffic, the HTTP requests going out, the HTTP responses coming back. So while we use the browser to record it, we don't use the browser to run it. Now that's really, really important for several reasons. Predominantly, we can then use them for load tests. Now, load tests are often about simulating user load, and that load could, in fact, drive up into the thousands of users. If we were really using the browser like a coded UI test to run these things, well, Steve, what do you think the chances are of us going and spinning up 1,000 instances of a browser on your machine today?
On my big machine at home? No, I'm just...
I will challenge you with any machine.
It's not happening. Even a few hundred megabytes per browser instance, you're talking blown away at 50 at most.
Oh, yes.
At most.
And then the value of the data coming back, the reliability of it's out the window as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas if I'm using a network class to do the same thing, well, spinning up 1,000 instances of a class, you know, without the weight of a browser, well, that's a whole different thing.
Yep.
So load tests utilize web performance tests to generate the load that it needs. So those two often work or often are found together.
Yeah.
So that's a look at all of those different tests. How are we going? So Microsoft Test Manager, all I wanted to do was call out the role of MTM, and I think you've opened up MTM there earlier in the session here today, where you've opened up MTM and said, well, this is really the tool that our manual testers are going to use. And you know what? I'm probably not going to show that demonstration.
I kind of walked through the creation of it. We walked into a test plan. We created a test, a bucket there for a requirement test suite. And under that test suite, we created a test plan, or a test case. And the test case had some test steps. Mm-hmm. There might have been more test cases in there that you would see, but the idea is there. We created that hierarchy already.
And certainly we'll see a lot more of that when we do the jumpstart for the test exam.
That's so absolutely true.
It'll be fine for now. Okay, in terms of customizing a team project, what I might suggest is why don't we take a break now?
That might be a good idea.
I'm going to suggest that we go and recaffeinate.
Okay.
And I think we're going to do that after we come back from the break. And we'll also get stuck into our final module.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Excellent. Let's do.
I'll see you in 10.
See you then.